I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not.
It has been called the worst movie ever made.
Why, Lisa? Please talk to me, please.
And this week on Download This Show, we take you inside one of the strangest media success stories in history. The Room is a cult film starring a...
How dare you talk to me like that? You should tell me everything.
Bizarre Eastern European, we think, man, that became a massive cult hit with midnight screenings, internet memes, and much more. And we are going to meet a man who was right there at the heart of it.
My mom was horrified. I think her two words were, oh no. And then later she told me, oh, she was kind of celebrating inside because she's like, the Hollywood dream is over. He's gonna move home, that's it.
Plus, Uber hacked Amazon launch in Australia and why Islamic State hates Swedish radio. This is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell and welcome to Download This Show. And it is a very big welcome to our panelists this week. She is the newly minted editor of Gizmodo. I don't know why I said it like that. I've become a bad cartoon character. It's called Gizmodo, and her name is Rae Johnson. Welcome back.
Thanks for that intro, Mark.
You are so welcome. It's really late in the year, guys. Don't forget, you can tweet along. The hashtag is DownloadThisShow. Our second panelist is the one, the only, Claire Riley from CNET. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Didn't mess up your employer now, did I?
I almost thought that you weren't going to introduce me because you do the tweet along normally after you've introduced both guests. So I was like, guess I'll just leave, guys. It's been really good.
No, don't go. We need you.
Did you say introduced?
Probably. It's almost
December. We're not editing anything.
We're very good at words.
All right. There's a lot to get through in the show today. Amazon, the long-awaited arrival of Amazon in Australia has happened. But what does it actually mean? Because I've been able to buy things on Amazon for a while. So what's different about now than like 3 days ago, Claire Riley?
Essentially, what's different now is that Amazon's coming to Australia and it's going to massively shake up the retail industry. Everyone's been saying that, so that's not necessarily new information.
Well, the hype itself has been, there's been 50,000 articles going, how will this industry cope with Amazon? How will this industry cope with the arrival of Amazon?
So what we'll see is lots of disruption in the early stages, but then it'll settle down. They won't be able to cut prices forever because manufacturers will eventually get kind of teed off. The thing that I'm hearing from a lot of retail industry insiders is that the broad but shallow providers, the department stores perhaps, they have the most to lose because they don't have a USP, a unique selling point. So if you think about, say, a David Jones, well, they've really pitched themselves as luxury department store. Maybe Maya, what's Maya's selling point in Australia? What do you go to Maya for? You might go to Maya for something, but they are a department store that potentially has something to lose. A lot of flack for Harvey Norman, and Jerry Harvey's been very vocal about Amazon. But when you go to a Harvey Norman store, you're normally dealing with people who know their stuff. They'll throw in, you know, interest-free. So those are the kinds of things that retailers are going to be trying to do to say, all right, we've got a different selling point. We've got a different way of service than just ordering online. You get convenience with Amazon, but we're going to do something different.
Right. In the United States, you can get Amazon to do almost everything from groceries to nappies to toilet paper. And of course, there's the Alexa system where you can talk to the device in your house and it does things.
Oh, it does so many things.
So how is that offering going to be different to what people have in this country?
Well, we are getting Amazon Prime here, but not straight away. And we don't know exactly when all of the features of it will roll out. So in the States, it gives you free two-day shipping, free same-day delivery. It also gives you access to Prime Now, which is a two-hour delivery service for certain postcodes.
Certain things, yeah.
So around that giant, what is it, 24,000 square meter warehouse that they've got set up in Melbourne.
But they have a special name for it, though. It's a fulfillment center.
Oh, it's a fulfillment
center. It makes it sound like a freaking day spa.
A wellness center.
And it also gives you access to Prime Video, which we do already have here with a very limited offering.
Yeah, so they did a soft launch of basically when the Top Gear guys had their show launch, the Grand Tour, and it's sort of been available and you could watch like some things but not everything. And I think the top line shows like your Transparents and stuff like that, they had already gone to Stan in Australia. So the offering of Prime, I tell you this because I'm the idiot that handed over money. I was like, I will watch the new Top Gear show. I watched 5 minutes of the first episode and I'm like, like, I don't care enough about this. No. So anyway, tax deduction there.
Yeah.
Of course, the other main issue is pricing, right? Anybody who's ever shopped online knows that there's a massive difference between, you know, what you pay for things in the United States to everywhere else. Do we have a sense of where we sit in that spectrum, Claire?
Yeah. So what's really, really interesting about Amazon in Australia compared to Amazon in, say, the US, in the US, you are allowed, as a manufacturer, you're allowed to set a minimum advertised price for your TV, your camera, whatever product you're selling. So retailers, whether they're online or bricks and mortar, they can't go below that advertised price. They can offer discounts and other things later on down the track. In Australia, that's called retail price management and it's illegal. So you can suggest a price as a manufacturer and say, please don't sell our TV below this. But retailers don't have to stick to it. So Amazon will be able to come into the market with loss leaders and just run really hard and use deep pockets and market power to say, all right, we're launching, we're going to cut and slash so that you get across and you sign up for whatever services we're offering. That's not sustainable because eventually the manufacturers will say, well, we're not going to deal with you if you're going to sell our TVs for half off and screw our relationships and, you know, we're not able to sell anywhere else. But it's really got interesting implications for kind of competition and the way we're going to get prices in Australia.
Yeah, there's also the ACCC's predatory pricing laws as well, which means you essentially can't push someone out of business with your pricing. But how that will relate to how Amazon works in this country and whether those retailers that are tipped to lose a lot of money are going to try and push that angle will be really interesting to see.
Well, I spoke to Rod Sims this week, the head of the ACCC, and he's like, yeah, Amazon, it's going to be great. Like, he's like,
I'm sorry, is he Steve Irwin? Yeah. Ian Bourne? Is that who he is?
Too soon?
It's too soon.
No. I was going to make some joke about how the fact I don't write for Crikey, but
okay, we're all fired.
Yeah. But he was saying that they do have to watch things. Like, he was talking about competition, and it's great. No one ever likes competition, but they lift their game. And he was talking about the taxi industry on that front. So there's a couple of things that they have to watch out for. And he says that sometimes global companies, he talked about Apple, they come in and they say, right, we're going to do this, and this is how we work. And, you know, we're awesome. We're a big tech company. And then, well, you're breaking the law in Australia. So if you want to be able to work here, you have to stick to our laws, and you may not like them, but it's the way the country works in retail and competition terms. So that'll be really interesting.
Download This Show is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell. Our guests this week, Ray Johnson from Gizmodo and Claire Riley from CNET. And there's very big news building in Washington, D.C. about something called net neutrality. So there's an underlying principle behind the internet, which is basically like different services don't get treated any differently, right? So the speed at which you get Netflix, the speed at which you get Facebook are basically treated with neutrality. Now, some of that was enshrined by law under the Obama administration, and that's what we're talking about being removed right now under the Trump administration. Now, there's sort of an interesting argument here that net neutrality as a concept has been very helpful in that it has made a level playing field for every new startup that, you know, just because somebody was owned by a major telecommunications company, that they couldn't get preferential treatment. So they couldn't get faster internet for Hulu, which is owned by a certain telecommunications company. So Netflix was allowed to thrive. If you take away those protections, there's really huge potential consequences there, aren't there, Claire?
There's massive consequences, and it comes down to the question of what do we want the internet to be? Do we want the internet to be this amazing resource that you can access whether you live in the poorest regions or you're really loaded and you have access to whatever you want to pay for? It's access to information, communication. So Comcast in the US, they own NBC Universal. So it's very likely that
say Comcast is a telecommunications company. Yep. NBC Universal is a media company.
Big media company.
Universal Studios and all and movies and TV shows and streaming services.
Exactly, yeah. So if you're on Comcast, then it could be that NBC content is really easy to get, but you can't get anything from your favorite niche horror movie streaming service because they deprioritize that.
Well, they just deprioritize Netflix or one of the competitors, Fox's streaming service.
Exactly. Yeah. They block it, they throttle it, they make sure that it can't survive. Mm. And that's not ideal. I think in Australia, Ray and I were talking about this earlier, that we kind of like a lot of what this means in some ways, because when, say, Netflix introduced data-free deals,
I was going to say, Optus, isn't data-free deals, or, you know, not counting your data on certain streaming services? I mean, the ABC isn't counted, iView isn't counted on certain ISPs. Isn't that kind of an affront to the principles of net neutrality too?
It technically is, and Netflix got in a lot of strife. So Reed Hastings had to come out and apologize after setting up that deal with Optus, because everyone in the US was like, this is against your principles about net neutrality. neutrality. There are good things that come with it.
We should say Reed Hastings is the
CEO of Netflix. Yeah. Sorry. So there are certainly good things that come out of it, but the problem is, remember that you are potentially cutting people off from this massive resource.
This does come at a really interesting point, though, Ray, where a lot of what's going on in media and technology, particularly in the United States, in that big end of town, is consolidation. So telecommunications companies are buying massive media conglomerates. And for them, being able to prioritize their own services over a competitor represents real danger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's going to be really odd, quite dystopian, actually. Mm.
You are listening to the voices of Ray Johnson from Gizmodo and Claire Riley from CNET. And my name is Mark Fennell, and I'm from just like all of the public broadcasters. So it has been a controversial week at Uber because it always is, and that company is a magnet for drama. It turns out it's been revealed that Uber paid hackers, right, to delete stolen user data for 57 million people, 600,000 drivers. What the hell happened?
Yeah, so Uber's had a bit of a shocker. They were hacked in October 2016 and the personal information, names, addresses, license numbers on 57 million users were hacked. The new CEO kind of just found out about, not great for Dara Khosrowshahi because...
Yeah, because he's only been in for how long?
He came in, I think, in August after Travis Kalanick left a bit of a nightmare for him. So he's just found out about it and found out that the company paid $100,000 to have the information, which was stolen off a cloud service by two people, to have it deleted. Now, they say that credit card details and social security numbers weren't compromised. But, of course, that doesn't really matter because when it comes to identity theft, you don't really need that information. You can cancel your credit card in a minute, but very difficult to change your identity. So Uber's come under massive fire for not only paying to have the data deleted, but then not really telling anyone.
It's every step of the way, every decision that's been made, you know, not letting people know that their personal information has been put at risk is absolutely up there, number one. But paying off hackers is just... it is not what people do.
It shows, as you say, that we're happy to pay bounties. So hold our stuff to ransom and we'll pay you off. You know, It is recommended guidance in privacy principles and security principles that you do not pay to get your stuff back in a hack. The second reason is these people are criminals. Oh, yeah. Cool. We're deleting your stuff. Look at us deleting it.
Yeah, what proof do they have that it was deleted?
They don't have any proof. And so they've paid $100,000 of potentially useless money to a bunch of criminals.
We will definitely keep an eye on that story. I'm sure more details will come out and we will definitely revisit that in the coming weeks. Staying on the topic of things that were hacked. This is a fascinating story that I really wanted to get into the show this week because it just shocked me. So it turns out IS militants have allegedly hacked into a Swedish radio station in Malmo, which I'm describing that way purely because I went to IKEA one time, and they took over the broadcast. Ray, what the hell?
This is not uncommon.
How is this not uncommon?
This has happened throughout history. So if you're emitting a broadcast at the same frequency as the radio station or TV broadcast network as well, and it's strong enough and you're close enough, basically you can overpower it and you can either, you know, you can broadcast whatever you want.
Yeah. In the case of a radio station in North Korea, The Final Countdown by Europe.
Yes, and on this day, actually, would you believe, in 1987, an episode of Doctor Who was hacked, and it was a guy wearing a mask that went on a rant for 90 seconds calling everyone nerds.
Accurate, to be fair.
Yeah. That's a pretty pro hack.
So what they did was they had a song, which roughly translates to For the Sake of Allah, which they played for 30 minutes on the Mix Megapulse
station.
What
a banger it was, though, Mark.
And that went out to about 1.4 million people. So Is there a sense of, firstly, like, why? Is there a sense of what was the instigating factor for this with the radio station in question?
There's this fabulous New York Times reporter that kind of infiltrates IS social media networks and just watches these people and says, like, guys, you're not that tech savvy in some ways. So it's like, let's hack a radio station and play our awesome song. Like, my question is, what about the producers who were just off on a coffee break? Like, I look into the producers in the back room there. You know, are you guys taking half hour long?
ABC producers are paying complete attention at all times.
Excellent job.
And now, if you could wake up, that'd be great, Emily. Awesome, thanks. Thank you.
But it's not new, and it's not even stuff like you need to push a broadcast on the same frequency. I mean, there was a radio station in San Francisco this year that was down for like a month. So they were still broadcasting. They lost their broadcast overnight, but they had a ransomware attack. So it was nothing to do with the radio broadcast, but it compromised all of their actual digital systems. So they lost radio.
Give us your money and we'll tell everybody there's no real icy core cans of Coke.
Yeah, right. And it's suddenly you're running an office where you have to print everything out. Every job takes 4 to 5 times as long. So
Massive impact. Yeah.
You could cripple a radio station in any number of ways. And I think create a connection, you create a way of getting
hacked. Giving everyone ideas.
And like, you could do it with a Raspberry Pi and a piece
exactly.
of wire.
You do not, like, you obviously read the same article I did this morning.
Just for those playing at home, Raspberry Pi in this context is a teeny tiny lo-fi computer. It is not the delicious cake.
But also, you could do it with a literal Raspberry Pi you've baked, walk into the ABC offices to security, have this fabulous pie, take your piece of wire and go jam it in some control boards. That also would work. So,
how do we let you into this building?
I do not know. And you consistently do it. So
download this show is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in culture, media, technology. And about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit earlier, I remember somebody emailing me a link to a video. And the video was a movie that has been reputed to be the worst film ever made. Its status has spread like wildfire across the internet. It was called The Room. If you had to explain to somebody like what the hell The Room was, somebody with no frame of reference, I don't even know. Like, how would you even start to explain it, Claire?
I don't know. Imagine finding a random guy at a service station, asking him to script, direct, act in a movie that had zero semblance of plot, that was set dressed with stock photography that was just stuck into bad photo frames, had some really questionable romantic scenes in it, and a rooftop football playing scene that just made zero sense within the context of the film. That's The Room. It's confusing. It's a hot mess, but it's kind of almost so bad that it's good.
Ray, you're shaking your head so far, I think you're about to sprain something.
It's the so bad that it's good thing that I just cannot get my head around. I know people that are obsessed with this movie. They love this movie. They have private screenings of it. They want to book out cinemas. I was forced to sit in a room with like 10 of my dearest, closest friends while they all had the best time. And I'm sitting there going, I would rather, you know, stick forks in my eyes.
Or stick spoons.
I don't even I don't understand how it falls into the so bad it's good category, because it's so painful.
Well,
it's so painful.
Do you know what might explain it? There's a new movie that's out next week called The Disaster Artist, which actually tells the behind the scenes story of how this film was made. So the guy at the center of this is a guy by the name of Tommy Wiseau. Nobody knows how old he is. Nobody knows where he got his money from, because he self-funded The Room himself. And nobody knows where he was raised either, because his accent is sort of a bit Eastern European, but nobody knows. The person that has come close to knowing is Greg Sestero, who plays Mark in the film The Room.
Oh, hi, Mark.
He was an aspiring actor. He was, you know, going up for roles in Dawson's Creek and stuff like that in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then he met this guy named Tommy Wiseau, and Tommy has all this money, funds this movie, drops Greg Sestero into this movie, and Greg's just hoping that nobody sees it because it affects his career, because, as you say, it's the worst thing ever. Eventually, The Room comes out. It becomes this massive, huge cult hit. And Greg's only recourse is to write a book about the making of the movie. And it turns out the behind-the-scenes story of The Room is insane. And now it's been turned into a feature film. It stars both Dave Franco and James Franco as Greg and Tommy Wiseau. But a little bit earlier, I sat down with the original, the real Greg Sestero, or Mark, as the case might be, to find out, firstly, how the hell this film got made. But I got him to go back to the very beginning to start and just explain to me his first introduction to Tommy Wiseau, which happened at this acting class in LA. And what was it about this very strange man that appealed to him?
I was pretty much at rock bottom at that point. I was ready to give up on acting. I didn't have any support from family. I had a French mom who believed I should have been a lawyer or a doctor, and I was throwing my life away. And I watched this very bizarre man who looked, you know, a cross between a pirate and a caveman, go up and perform this Shakespearean sonnet that I could not understand. Everybody in the class was horrified, and there was just something liberating about watching him not care and argue with the teacher and show no fear that I thought, let's find out who this guy is. I was really the only one in the class that wasn't scared of him, and I approached him to do a scene together.
Have you come any closer to working out some of the gaps in Tommy's story?
I've worked out a few of the gaps, but there's still things I don't know, which is amazing considering it's been 20 years. We're in the year 2017. He still remains an enigma. I know he was a successful retail guy in real estate. How that happened, I have no idea. But he just wanted to make a film. He said, don't worry about money. We worry about movie. And that's what he stuck by.
Your role when the film was in production was sort of like an interpreter for between Tommy and normal people, for lack of a better term. Was that something you had signed up for originally? Did you know when he embarked on this production that that was going to end up being your role?
No, I mean, it evolved pretty extremely. I came on just to help him like cast people. And then all of a sudden I was like a line producer, which I'd never done before. And then the night before filming, he offered me the role of Mark, even though somebody had already been cast. So
the night before.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden I was doing a bunch of things on set. Mm. So it was none of that I could foresee, but making a film really is like going to war. It's an impossible feat. So I just ended up trying to kind of keep the whole thing together. Mm. Tommy is a unique communicator. He's not somebody I'd hire to communicate. So I was trying to kind of fill in the blanks and keep everybody cool as much as possible.
So when was the moment when you had to sit down and watch the film for the first time?
Yeah, I got a chance to see the rough cut with my family. My mom was horrified. I think her two words were, oh no. And then later she told me, oh, she was kind of celebrating inside because she's like, the Hollywood dream is over. He's going to move home. That's it.
I want to meet your mom. Your mom like, sounds like fun.
She's like, I got my wish. There's no way this thing's going anywhere. And I've never seen my dad laugh harder. And then I got to see with an audience at the premiere, and that was really scary because it was people that I did not know and that were actually seeing this for the first time, and they were laughing. There was laughter throughout the entire film.
And was that the moment, or was dad the moment when you realized that what had been created was unintentionally comedic?
I knew it was unintentionally comedic. I didn't know to which the degree that it was until I saw it with strangers.
Yeah, right.
Because I knew my dad would laugh. You know, it's kind of an inside joke, but when strangers were laughing as Tommy was blowing his head off, I didn't know that would happen. And it was just, yeah, it was literally like watching a brilliant comedy come to life. And I think Tommy was stunned that people were laughing so much.
Well, I was going to ask you how Tommy was reacting when people, because so much of his ego is clearly caught up in this, as it would be, by the way, for anybody that makes a film. So how was his emotional terrain in the course of that film, realizing that this thing that he intended to be quite serious was actually very funny?
He didn't really show too much reaction that night. I know that he was stunned. He said to me, people laugh at everything. And yeah, within a week it was changed to experience this quirky new black comedy. So
did he recognize that? He recognized that there was an opportunity.
Yeah, he recognized it. And then I think ultimately for Tommy, he said, when people see my movie, they won't sleep for 2 weeks. So his goal was to get a huge reaction from an audience, and he did. It just wasn't in the way he intended. So he rolled with it and figured, hey, yeah, I kind of meant for it to be partly funny. Let's roll with that.
How does Tommy feel about how he is represented in the movie and the book?
He calls the book the Red Bible, but he said he only approves of it 40% because he said that the making of The Room, he believes The Room is great. He thinks it's not exactly what happened on set, that it was a much more cohesive shoot. But he approves of the movie 99%. And he, I think overall he's really happy.
What about you? Like, this is not necessarily the career that you embarked upon. You've now become an award-winning writer with the book, and you've led to the creation of a movie in a way. Is this necessarily what you set out doing, or are you kind of happy to kind of roll with the adventure?
To be honest with you, looking back, to me, this is more rewarding than if I would have just been on TV shows or in film, because I got to see things from a much deeper perspective. Yeah, it's rewarding to just be an actor, but ultimately I was always a creative person. Storytelling was my first love, and that has brought to a much more significant piece of creativity than had I just been an actor in shows. And you'd never expect to be in a terrible film and be still talking about it 15 years later, and for it to be so insane that that story became its own film. But to me, I'd rather have something like that be so insane and be part of something that will probably live on forever than just have done like some episodes of Dawson's Creek and a few sci-fi movies. This is more rewarding if you could be open to the fascinating parts of it.
Of all of the things that have become massively cultishly popular in the film, so it's the "Oh, hi, Marx," or the "You're tearing me apart," or those lines that people quote, which one of those things surprised you that people would enjoy so much?
I'm just surprised people were willing to endure those sex scenes.
You know? Because you left the cinema every time.
I still have never watched those sex scenes. They feel like they're 100 minutes long. I thought that was going to be the part that nobody would sit through.
And you were quite insistent on like keeping your jeans on, whereas Tommy was very happy to be as naked as humanly possible.
He said that he needs to show his ass or this movie won't sell. And I was like, man, that's all your glory. Let's put all that on you.
Right. What is it that people get wrong about Tommy?
I think that he's all weird. You know, I think, you know, you have obviously the bizarre physical presence and the way he talks, but there's actually a very lovable, charming side to Tommy that is very engaging, very witty. And I think if you can kind of get past the exterior, he's just a guy like all of us that wants to be cared about.
He seems to be very in love with Americana, like the idea of America. What do you put that down to? Why is he so into that idea?
Because I'm sure he's lived other places that didn't accept him and that he's always felt like he couldn't have the life he always wanted. And something about coming to America, whatever happened in those years before I met him, I'm still trying to figure that out, it gave him that freedom mentally and physically to be more of who he wanted to be. And I think he celebrates America for giving him that chance.
So much of what is the Hollywood dream is this idea of persistence. It's about sort of, everyone knows that if you go and try and become an actor in Hollywood, that you'll be knocked back 1,000 times, but you have to believe in yourself. But in some ways, the story of Tommy, and certainly I think towards the end of your book, there's this sense that persistence of that nature, of that scale, is kind of a double-edged sword. And I'm wondering, how do you feel about the Hollywood dream now? When you see young actors kind of step into LA now, what would you warn them about?
I don't know. It's one of those things I would never want to do over again. I really got randomly extremely, extremely lucky. I mean, this has sort of transformed the Hollywood mystique for me, because it shows you can get in if you really want it, and you got to go out and create your own thing. And I think that's what The Room taught me, is there's people that make it the traditional way, which I think we all want, you know, go to LA, get an agent, be in big projects and continue to do that. But it's kind of a cool thing to try to find your own way in it.
What's the thing about The Room that you're most keen to forget?
Sex scenes. Outside of that, I can handle it. I think it's the sex scenes that are... And the ending of the movie is painful to watch. And those glycerin tears just shine way too bright. And it's just humiliating. But outside of that, I'm pretty good sport.
How long did it take you to get to that point, though? Like, was there a point where you're just like, I can't even think about this production?
Well, here's the thing. I never expected anything from The Room. I never, like, really tried hard. I think it would be a lot harder if I gave my, you know, put my heart into the performance and people are laughing all the way through it. I was kind of going through the motions, so I kind of understand the audience. You know, you kind of suck in certain parts, and it's like, yeah, guys, I get it. So I've always had a sense of humor about it.
Greg, thanks so much for your time. And I can't believe we didn't start this interview with a high mark. That was a missed opportunity for all of us. Greg,
thanks
so much for your time, and congratulations on this unusual but absolutely bangingly successful film.
Thank you very much.
That is all we have time for this week on Download This Show, your mix of media, culture, and technology. Claire Riley, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Ray Johnson, thank you for coping through our Room conversation. I sense it was traumatic for you.
It's okay, I'll live, thanks.
And that is it for me. This has been another episode of Download This Show, and thank you for listening.